Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Many past KVC Arts programs can be found via podcast through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Tonight we'll hear from the group Songbird with a couple of seasonal tunes. It's not too late for that. First, though, the main portion of the program will be in conversation with Wink Martindale. Although we will occasionally see Wink on TV with an acting role, we generally think of him as a host, a game show host, and earlier a radio and TV host of a program not unlike American Bandstand called Teenage Dance Party. But what I only recently found out is that not only did Wink Martindale have a brief singing career, he was awarded a gold record for a piece called Deck of Cards.
During the North African campaign, a bunch of soldier boys had been on a long hike, and they arrived in a little town called Casino. The next morning, being Sunday, several of the boys went to church. A sergeant commanded the boys in church, and after the chaplain had read the prayer, the text was taken up next. Those of the boys who had a prayer book took them out, but this one boy had only a deck of cards, and so he spread them out.
Deck of Cards is a narrative based on scripture that was recorded in 1946 and supposedly written by a country singer named T. Texas Tyler. It came out on Starday Records right after the war. Told about a soldier who used a deck of cards in church because he didn't have a Bible. And it became a big hit, both country and pop, mostly country, went to number one. And in 1959, when I had just signed a recording contract with Randy Wood, founder of Dot Records, he remembered Deck of Cards, and he called me into his office one day here in Hollywood, and he said, let me play something for you. I think I've got the perfect thing for you to record as the first record on Dot. And he put on this old scratchy 78 RPM record by T. Texas Tyler, and about halfway through it, I thought to myself, not aloud, but I thought to myself, who's going to buy a semi-religious talking record? The number one record at the time was Stagger Lee by Lloyd Price. There was Venus by Frankie Avalon. And I thought, kids buy records. Who's going to buy this? You know, the Ace was One God, the Deuce, the Old and New Testament. He went through the Bible like that. And after it was over, he picked the needle up off the record and he said, well, what do you think? And I thought, this is my first record on Dot, and I'm thrilled to be making records, and it was my first one, and I thought, I'm going to say I love it. And so I said, Randy, I think it's terrific, although I thought just the opposite. Well, fade to black and come up on about 3 weeks later, we went into his studio here in Hollywood. He put some voices behind me. We recorded Deck of Cards. And I sang a song on the backside of it, written by Billy Vaughn, called Now You Know How It Feels. And that record came out, and I thought, well, this is just going to die. But surely enough, about 6 weeks later, Bob Clayton, a DJ in Boston, I think it was on WBZ, he put it on his number one rated show one morning, I guess just to see if it had anything, and he played it. And the switchboard lit up like the proverbial Christmas tree. And the next day, Christine Hamilton, who was vice president of sales at Dot Records, called me when I got off the air at KHJ doing my morning show. And he said, Winky, Winky, she called me Winky. Winky, we just got an order for 10,000 out of Boston for your record. I said, oh my gosh. Well, from there, it just swept the country. And by November, I received a call to come to New York and perform it on the Ed Sullivan Show, Toast of the Town. And it's still a record that people ask me about to this day. It's followed me my entire career. I have people come up to me now, David, and say, are you the same Wink Martindale who recorded Deck of Cards? And my answer is always the same. I said, do you think there are two guys with a silly name like Wink Martindale walking the planet? I said, yeah, that's me. Well, that's my story of Deck of Cards. And I recorded some albums and other narratives over the years for Dot and had minimal success, but never like Deck of Cards. It's timeless because of the wording from Scripture.
Truly. You know, whether or not a person has faith of any kind, this song and this story, it's still such a positive, affirming message. And so it's a wonderful thing. It ought to be with us today. That's quite wonderful, I think.
I think so, yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So, you see, sir, My pack of cards serves me as a Bible, an almanac, and a prayer book. And friends, the story is true. I know. I was that soldier.
I'm glad that you mentioned the, yeah, like there could be more than one Wink Martindale out there. I'm glad you said it because that saved me from saying it's way cool. Okay. I remember the TV game shows Gambit from when I was skipping grade school and watching game shows, and Tic-Tac-Doe from when I was, well, skipping middle school and high school occasionally, watching a lot of game shows. We will get to these, but I'd like to go to Tennessee for just a bit. You were born in Jackson, Tennessee. I bring this up because I'm from Murray, Kentucky, just barely above Jackson, Tennessee. It's in the western part of the state. We have that same dialect there, and so you get the same question that I often get, and that is, why don't you sound, quote, like that? You know, to put it differently, did you work on a more neutral dialect when you were starting in radio, or did you just speak that way? I mean, the western Kentucky and western Tennessee dialect, that's a thick one.
Oh, yeah, I can go back home now. And I'll be there for 5 minutes, and I'll be talking like this. Oh, hi there, Bob. How y'all doing? Come on over. Let's go have a Coke. Yeah? But I never worked on trying to lose my dialect, my southern accent. I think that perhaps one reason it never has shown in my work professionally is that from the time I was about 7 or 8 years old, I knew I wanted to be, quote-unquote, on the radio. And so I used to listen to the radio constantly as a kid, and I'd try to emulate the guys on radio. And those guys on radio didn't sound Southern, and so I think, without even realizing it, I kind of put on a flair, so to speak, and tried to sound like they did. And so I didn't come across sounding Southern with an accent. And that's the only reason I can think of that I never have had a Southern accent. I just opened my mouth, and it was there one day.
Gotcha, sure. I put it this way, as far as myself, I don't speak this way because I'm in NPR. I'm in NPR because I speak this way. So, yeah. Well, now let's look at your radio days. This is at WHBQ, and I'm sure you could guess the story that I'm going to ask you to tell. Maybe one of the more documented stories, but it would be so much better to get it in your words. This is WHBQ when you were showing some friends the studio, and one of your colleagues had been getting a lot of wonderful reactions from this very new record from this unheard-of guy at this point. Sam Phillips brought a record in.
It was a hot July night in 1954. I was morning man at WHBQ Radio in the Chisco Hotel in downtown Memphis, and I happened to be at the radio station this particular night, although I had to get up early and open up the radio station. We went on the air at 5 o'clock. This was before the days of 24-hour radio.
Sure, sign on and sign
off. But some of my high school football buddies from Jackson, Tennessee, had come over, and they wanted to see the studios at WHBQ. So I was showing them around, and in the middle of my little tour, I heard this commotion coming out of a studio that Dewey Phillips occupied, doing a show every night called Red Hot and Blue. Dewey was a crazy DJ. There's only been one. There'll never be another like Dewey. Just a wild DJ. Said anything, did anything, played anything, broke more records on turntables than anybody I'd ever seen just because he threw them on the turntable so hard. But he was playing this record, and I heard this commotion, and I excused myself from my group, and I went in, and it turned out that Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records, had walked in with this acetate. It wasn't even a record yet. 3 hours earlier in the afternoon, he had recorded this truck-driving singer for Crown Electric named Elvis Presley on a song called That's All Right, Mama, an old Arthur Crudup rhythm and blues song that Elvis liked a lot. And Sam knew that if Dewey played it, he would know immediately whether or not he had a hit, because Dewey had 65% of the audience at nighttime from 9 to midnight. And if he played a record and it took off, it could be a regional hit in the Memphis area the very next day. So he played it, switchboard lit up, played it again, played 7 times in a row.
Oh.
And it was just amazing. It was just this semi-country pop record called That's All Right, Mama by Elvis Presley. And I happened to be the one designated by Sam, who had the telephone number of his parents. I was designated to call him. So I called, And Mrs. Presley, Gladys, answered the phone. Of course, they were listening because they were excited, too, that the record was getting such positive response. And I said, Mrs. Presley, where's Elvis? Dewey would like for him to come down to the station to do an interview with him. And she said, well, he was so nervous about his record being played, he went to see a double feature Western at the Suzor's Theater. So they got in their truck, and they went over and walked up and down the aisle, found him sitting there by himself watching this Western, whispered to him about the excitement. He was thrilled. Brought him down to the radio station. Dewey put him on the air for his very first interview. And I met him that night, and he was my friend until the day he died. In fact, I am the only living person of six who were there that night. There was Gladys, Vernon, Sam, Elvis, Dewey, and me. And everybody's gone except me. But it was quite an evening, David, because we knew something amazing was happening, but we had no idea that music was being changed that night. And it would never, ever, ever be quite the same as it was before that hot July evening in 1954.
My gosh. Wow. And I understand that this could be a fact or fiction. I'd love to get it straightened out from you. I understand that you have reported that Elvis admitted much later on, this interview with Elvis was without him knowing that he was on the air.
That's right. He came into the studio, and he sat down, and there happened to be a microphone sitting there. Dewey Phillips started asking him questions. And with every question, of course, Elvis would answer it. And after about 10 minutes of Q&A, Elvis said to Dewey, Mr. Phillips, I thought you were going to interview me. And Dewey looked at him, and he said, son, I just did. He had no idea, Elvis didn't, that the microphone was on in front of him. In fact, he didn't even notice it. It was the first Q&A that he ever did on the air after that record came out.
Oh, my gosh.
And in fact, Sam didn't even have a B-side yet.
Oh.
It wasn't until the following Thursday he went in and recorded the old Bill Monroe bluegrass song called Blue Moon of Kentucky. And they put that out on the flip side on Sun. And, of course, as they say, the rest is history.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past KVCR's programs can be found via podcast through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Later in the program, we'll hear from the group Songbird with a couple of seasonal tunes. Right now, back to Wink Martindale. Of course, we'll hear about game shows, but first, his earliest days in TV, and again, Elvis Presley. Well, you went from radio to WHBQ-TV in Memphis then as the host of Mars Patrol. This was your move into TV?
That's correct.
If you could describe this to us, I only know it as a science fiction-themed children's television program. Ray Bradbury may be brand new at this point. Were they taking sci-fi writers at the time and doing enactments? What kind of a show was this?
Okay, let me just explain how it all came about.
Please.
As I mentioned earlier, I was doing the Clock Watchers morning show, which was my dream job when I was a kid growing up in Jackson, Tennessee, because everybody in my hometown listened to WHBQ radio.
Hmm.
So to get the Clock Watchers show in the morning was a dream come true.
Hmm.
Well, I'd only been at WHBQ radio for about a year when WHBQ television, Channel 13, went on the air as a CBS affiliate. And my mentor, Bill Grumbles, and the station manager, John Cleghorn, called me into the office one day, sat me down, and said, we want you to do a kid's show on television. And, of course, you could have knocked me over with a feather because I just wanted to be on the radio. It never really occurred to me, although I was watching television from time to time,
sure,
that to be on TV was a possibility. And so after I picked myself up off the floor, I said, well, sure, tell me about it. And Mark Forrester, who was the assistant PD at the radio and TV station, they were looking for local programming, and he had come up with this idea called Mars Patrol, and they put my name on it, and it became Wink Martindale of the Mars Patrol, and it was a daily half hour, 5:30 to 6 p.m. in the evening, sponsored by Bosco, and we had a little set, not a very fancy set, but airplane seats to actually take in from fighter airplanes, and graduated up, and there were six seats, three on one side and three on the other, and down in the front, I would have my seat, and I would be the leader of the group, and I would interview the kids every day for a few minutes, And then we would segue into the old Rocky Jones Space Ranger serials, the old B-movies that they used to play between features on Saturday afternoon.
Sure.
And we'd play about 5 or 6 minutes of Rocky Jones. Then we'd come back, and I'd talk to the kids some more. We'd drink our Bosco and milk. You know, it was a great experience for me because it taught me how to ad-lib than anything I'd ever done on radio, because if you can... It's like Art Linkletter said, kids say the darndest things, and by golly, they do. One kid said to me one day, right in the middle of the thing, he said, you know, Mr. Martindale, I've got to go pee-pee. And that was the mildest thing that ever happened. But we would come back and talk and have some more Bosco, and then we'd go back to the film. So that's the way it was for 30 minutes a day, 5:30 to 6 in the afternoon. And it became an immediate hit. It was just a gigantic hit, number one in its time period. And I did that for 2 complete years. And when it sort of played its way out, they came to me with another idea. At the height of American Bandstand out of Philadelphia, WFIL, Dick Clark, they wanted to do a Saturday afternoon hour and a half, 90-minute show, and call it Top 10 Dance Party, where artists come on and lip-sync their records, just like American Bandstand. And so I moved from Wink Martindale of the Mars Patrol to this teenage show called Dance Party, and I had a co-hostess named Susie Bancroft, and it became an overnight hit. It was just a huge hit, sponsored for 90 minutes every Saturday afternoon, 5 to 6:30, by Coca-Cola. So I did that until I actually asked to be transferred by RKO from Memphis to Los Angeles in 1959.
Okay.
So that was my television career, the way it got started in Memphis. First Mars Patrol and then Dance Party. And then when I came out here, I was transferred by RKO and to KHJ-TV on Vine Street and did a show just like that starting in the summer of 1959. Almost 10 years I spent in Memphis were the best of my life. I thought the music of the 50s was terrific. I loved the songs. I just loved everything about that decade. In fact, I look back on my career and I think the decade of the 50s was my all-time favorite.
Nice, nice. While you were doing the Teenage Dance Party, Elvis, he made an appearance on the show. Were you able to bring him in through your friendship, or was this by this point? I mean, maybe only a couple of years later, but by this point, did you have to go through management of management and such a huge thing by then, Elvis, that is?
I had met Elvis that night in 1954, and like I said earlier, he became my friend till the day he died. And so, thanks to that friendship, he had just come to Memphis from Hollywood after doing his first picture, Love Me Tender.
Right.
And he was doing a charitable concert there at Russwood Park in Memphis, and he wanted to promote that. And, of course, dying to get him on my Dance Party show because he was already the biggest thing since baked bread. So he came on my show. It was the first filmed interview that he had ever done. It was 1956, 2 years after I had met him. And the security around the TV station that Saturday afternoon was unbelievable. Even the sales staff at the station, everybody came back to the station, although it was a day off for most of the working class people, but they all wanted to see Elvis Presley in person. So the station was just packed, and we had a little studio. We didn't have a lot of different high schools represented by the kids from different high schools would be the dancers. And we had a high school named Bartlett High School on that day. They were the lucky ones. And I had anticipated this interview for so long, it ended up lasting about 25 minutes. And I remember that there were so many questions that I wanted to ask Elvis, and I decided to put them on cue cards. And I slapped these questions on cue cards and put these cue cards. I had them all over the walls. I remember asking him one question during the interview. We did it in front of a jukebox where I did all my interviews. And I said, Elvis, when you got out of Humes High School, did you have any idea that any of this would be happening to you? He said, Wink, I didn't expect to get out of Humes High School. And I asked him another question, and he looked at the cue card that I was reading. He said, well, that's what it says right there. Somebody said, we didn't have videotape at that time, 1956. Videotape machines had just come out, but the stage WHBQ-TV hadn't yet purchased any. Mm-hmm. Or if they had, they hadn't arrived yet. And so somebody suggested to me, he said, you know, you should record this interview with Elvis. It could be valuable later because he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, of course, like I said, he had just done his first movie.
Yeah.
And Heartbreak Hotel had come out, his first million-selling record. And so I got Bob Zimmerman, a friend of mine, to come in and set up a 16-millimeter camera in front of the jukebox. And thank God I did, because I still have that interview. It was, about 25 minutes long. And I loaned it out to a couple of people, the master, over the years. And so I only have about 2 or 3 minutes remaining of the actual interview. Obviously, I have the whole thing on audio, which anybody could listen to by going to their computer. But it was quite a day and quite a memory in my career. In fact, it stands out like that night in 1954 when his first record was played by Dewey Phillips on WHBQ. Like that night, this day at Channel 13 turns out to be one of the fondest memories in my career.
Oh, just huge. I had it in my mind to ask you about some other standout moments from Teenage Dance Party, but I don't think we can, we just heard about Elvis. We can't really go bigger than
that. Can't top that.
No. Before we move on from there, just one more thing about Teenage Dance Party. Any cases of some of the producers back then, say, wanting to cut someone, like, who's this Ricky Nelson? I don't want him in. And then they turn out to be huge, something like that.
I was lucky, and I was truly blessed, I think, when I look back on my career, to have been in Memphis in the 1950s, because in 54, 55, 56, that was when Sun Records was turning out hit artists like no other record label in the country, be it Decca, RCA, Columbia. This little label started by Sam Phillips called Sun Records, there on Union Avenue in Memphis. They were recording and making stars of people like Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins from my hometown of Jackson. You name it, there were just so many. Roy Orbison was one of those artists who my producer heard sing Ooby Dooby, his first record on Sun, and I wanted him on the show, and my producer-director said, come on, let's wait till he has a hit. Well, it turned out that Ooby Dooby was a hit for Roy Orbison, and I did have him on the show. I won out over the producer, and he did come on and lip-sync Ooby Dooby, but in answer to your original question, he was one artist who almost got turned down for being on Dance Party.
Nice. I was hoping to hear something like that. Beautiful. Thank you.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Wink Martindale. We've been hearing about his early days in radio and TV. Now a move across the country and a move into game shows. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Many past KVC Arts programs can be found via podcast through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts.
Well, when you had made the move to Los Angeles, and so, gosh, there were a few different game shows before the ones that most of us know, and that would be, Gambit and Tic-Tac-Doe, but before that there was a What's This Song and a Words and Music. So when these folks approached you with the idea of hosting a game show, game shows were not new at this point. We had Groucho Marx and we had To Tell the Truth and we, various things like that. So what were your thoughts of hosting something like that? Because it had been music and interviews and stuff like that in the past. This would have been such a new thing for you, I would think.
Well, game shows, of course, as you know, David, have been around since the years of radio. Mm-hmm. And I had grown up listening to some game shows on radio. I remember when I was a soda jerk at Baker's Drugstore on Main Street in Jackson, Tennessee, as a teen and a preteen. Every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, we listened to a radio game show starring Burt Parks called Stop the Music.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, I think, around 1948, 49. It was a huge show. I mean, it was just before television took over. And everything would come to a halt on Sunday night as people listened to Stop the Music. So that was always in the back of my mind, I guess, because Fade to Black had come up on years later. I'm a disc jockey, a morning man at KFWB in Los Angeles. And I would get off the air every morning at 9 o'clock, and I would go downstairs to a little coffee shop called Aldo's on Hollywood Boulevard, have my breakfast with all the promo guys. And then I'd rush home to be there at noon to watch Password with Alan Ludden.
Oh, yeah.
I became totally addicted to Password. I just loved the show. It was simple. They've always said about game shows, what makes them successful? And my answer is always the same. KISS, keep it simple, stupid. This was a very simple little show, and I just loved it. And I did some research on Alan Ludden. God rest his soul. He was so good. And I found out that he came in 2 days a week, knocked out 10 shows, and played golf the other 5 days. And I thought, man, that's not a bad way to make a buck.
No.
And I went to my agent, the late Noel Rubeloff, and I said, Noel, I love game shows. And I said, you know, I've been watching Password and some of these other shows that are so successful now. I'd like to go on an audition as a host for a game show. And so he started sending me on auditions. And the second one I went on was a local show in L.A., and it was called What's the Name of That Song? It was on KTLA Channel 5, an L.A. local show. But the arrangement with the producers was that if it became successful in Los Angeles with good numbers, good ratings, it would revert to NBC as a daytime game show. And sure enough, it became successful. The title was shortened to What's This Song for TV Guide purposes. And I was the host. And you know, the guys in New York get to make the big bucks for making the big decisions. Bob Aaron was head of daytime at that time, and he thought that Wink was too juvenile sounding. So for that very first game show that I did, they knocked the K off, and for that show, I was Wynn Martindale. I remember that the announcer used to introduce me at the top of the show, and now here's the star of our show, Wynn Martindale. And I'd have to look around, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, that's me, and I'd run out. And so for that first show, I was Wynn Martindale, and it only lasted a year, but he got me launched in the world of game shows. And after that, nobody seemed to care about it being Wynn or Wink, and I reverted back to Wink Martindale.
That's
but that was
really
the first of, I've either hosted or produced or co-produced 21 different game shows over the years. Of course, Tic-Tac-Toe was the one that most people remember me by because it lasted the longest, but High Rollers with the big dice that Alex did first, and then I was brought back to NBC. I did a show, Las Vegas Gambit, which was originally on CBS's Gambit. We did that in Las Vegas on NBC. Did a show called Debt, where we paid off young people's credit card debt. I've done so many shows over the years, and I felt so blessed because of the fact that I got paid for playing games. It was almost like being Santa Claus. You know, you're giving away somebody else's money.
Oh, my gosh. I would say, wow. You mentioned Tic-Tac-Toe, and the other biggest one for you would have been Gambit, I presume.
Yeah.
With something like Gambit, did you ever have a sense of, okay, let's try playing this a little bit? This is a combination of asking questions and the game of blackjack. Did you try these things out yourself, launching these things? I'm curious how they would even think of combining two games for this and see if it even works. Did they do it just like a TV pilot and a test audience and see whether or not it did well?
Gambit was a production created by Peter Quigley Productions, Merrill Heater and Bob Quigley. They're both gone now. They also created Hollywood Squares and some other successful game shows, but I was just one of many, many possible hosts that were called into their offices to audition as host for that show. Even Dick Clark came in and auditioned for it. And they had created this show, and in answer to your question, basically, they had worked on this show for weeks and weeks and weeks in the offices, playing it with Merrill Heater as the host. The producer actually was the host, and they would bring in contestants, played the game. So they got all the details worked out. They got the game worked out beautifully, you know, trying to get to 21 without going over, the bonus game. All that was worked out in advance for weeks. And then they started bringing people in to see who they wanted to act as host. And I just really got lucky. I went in there, and they explained the game to me, and then I went in before an audience and with contestants and in front of the producers. They would watch each of us who came in to audition as host. They'd watch us do our thing, and about a month after I did my audition, I got a call one day from my agent, Noel Rubeloff, and he said, "You got the job." And that really got me launched in game shows. It was my first successful network game show.
Nice.
Gambit. It lasted almost 5 years at CBS. And I'll never forget, we were in our fifth year, and a show came on opposite us on NBC. And I watched that show, and I went to Bob Noah, my showrunner, and I said, "Bob, you know that new show that just came on opposite us on NBC? I said, "Don't worry about it." And he said, "Uh-uh, don't say that, because just as sure as you say something like that, that'll come back and bite you in the butt." Sure enough, you know what the show was? It was a little show called Wheel of Fortune.
Wheel of Fortune.
And so it dug into the ratings, and when it first went on the air, we had like a 36 share of audience. I mean, we had a huge audience for Gambit. But sure enough, week by week, month by month, it kept cutting into our ratings, And finally, we got canceled into our sixth year.
Oh, gosh. Chuck Woolery beat you out there. Wow. That was another part of my childhood, that and Gambit. I guess I would go back and forth between CBS and NBC on that one myself as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We already had the Game Show Network at some point. That was a surprise to me when I saw my aunt watching this. And I was like, we have The Price is Right from 1978 on TV now. We can watch this. And we do. We watch it on purpose. These old, old shows trying to guess the price of a new car. It's somewhere around $3,600, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you ended up, I guess this is like the Game Show Network and then even more. You started your own YouTube channel. And this was really cool. How did the inspiration for this come about? When did you decide to do this? And how, I believe, it came about in maybe just about 5 years ago?
Yeah, very simple. I have an associate that I work with in developing game shows, which we still do to this day. We have two in development now. In fact, we just had a pitch meeting earlier this week on one of the shows. But he came to me, John Ritchie Jr. is his name, and he said, you know, you should start this channel with your past and with your career and your history in the business. I think that we can put up a lot of your shows and pilots that you did that never got on the air. You know, we can do all of this and make it just very interesting. And so it was his idea, not mine. And so we started this about 5 years ago, and it's very simply been very successful, and I don't make any money on it, but it keeps your name out there. That's the main thing. It keeps you out there and lets people know you're still walking the planet and still alive and kicking.
Absolutely. And I have to say that your YouTube channel, that's where I learned about your gold record. That's where I learned about Deck of Cards and your singing career. So it's really cool. It's not only fun, but it's educational, and I just eat up information like that. I get out an album, the first thing I do is read all the liner notes before even...
Right. Right. Thank you.
You know? Yeah, you kind of have to. Just a couple of, I'd say, incidental things. You've had various bit parts here and there as far as television, and I'm talking about like The Bold and the Beautiful as a minister. How did that come about? Was this an agent thing, or did somebody go, wouldn't it be cool to have Wink Martindale in?
Yeah, my agent called me one day and said that there was a part they wanted me to play as a minister on The Bold and the Beautiful, and of course I was thrilled to death. I've always had problem memorizing lines, and I thought, well, if they'll put them on cue cards for me, if I don't have too many lines, maybe I can even memorize them. But they agreed to do whatever needed to be done, and I did that, no more, no less. There's no big story behind it, but I love doing it at CBS, and it came off pretty well, and they called me back again to do another episode, again playing a minister. And I always said my mom would have been so proud of me because she wanted me to be a preacher. She wanted to be a minister. And I used to say to Mom, I said, Mom, you know, you don't wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a preacher. You have to be called to the ministry.
Right.
Well, she never quite understood that. She never understood that I wanted to be in quote-unquote show business. But she did appreciate when I became rather successful in the business. She appreciated the fact that I had gotten into the business. She understood by that time. But yeah, I've always enjoyed doing little acting roles here and there. I don't fancy myself as an actor, but it's fun. You know, it's a good divergence from time to time.
Oh, most certainly. And one that I remember very, very distinctly from only a couple of years ago. This was a Kentucky Fried Chicken advertising campaign with Rob Lowe as Colonel Sanders. Again, was this an agent thing or a friend of a friend?
Just an agent thing. I didn't have to go on the audition, but they wanted me. And so, you know, usually you have to audition, no matter what your name is. In this day and age, I got a call earlier this week to audition for a spokesman's role. I think I'm going to go in for next Tuesday.
Beautiful.
But, you know, you got to audition for these things. But on that particular Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial, they wanted me in particular, so I didn't have to audition. But that was a lot of fun.
Nice, yeah.
All right, and I love their chicken.
There we go. Endorsement, endorsement. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to Wink Martindale. There's a lot to find at winkmartindale.com, including, maybe the unexpected, Wink Martindale's Rocket Fizz Soda. This could be fact or fiction. I understand you have or had a few dogs named after the various game shows that you've hosted.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
My wife, Sandy, and I just celebrated our 45th year.
Congratulations.
5th anniversary. And we are both Chihuahua lovers. So we have had Chihuahuas over the years. And in the room where I'm speaking to you right now in our den, we have a shrine dedicated to our Chihuahuas, and on each side of the table is a little lamp, and both of these lamps shine 24 hours a day. We never turn them off. They only go off when a light bulb goes out and we replace it. But on that table are all the pictures and the remains, the little urns of all of our Chihuahuas over the years, and we have on the urn their name and when they were born and when they passed. We're real Chihuahua fans, and we have two right now, one called Dude. He's our big boy, our youngest boy, D-U-D-E, Dude. Then we have a little lady Chihuahua, and she's 18 years old, which is old for a Chihuahua.
Yes.
Her name is Olivia Newton Martindale, and the reason she has the name Olivia Newton is because Wayne Newton gave this one to us, and we naturally wanted to get a little girl, and the only Olivia that I knew that had Newton in the name was Olivia Newton-John, so we named her Olivia Newton Martindale. And we cherish every day that God gives her to be with us because, as I say, she's 18 years old.
Oh, my God. I hope the best for that situation. I'm such
a dog
lover.
You know, when you lose one, it's like losing one of your children because they become members of your family.
Absolutely, yes. Huge dog lover here. So, yes, I couldn't tell you.
You know that.
Yeah, big time. Any of the game shows, you know, we spoke about Wheel of Fortune, and there's been some others that have been just so huge. Price is Right, Joker's Wild. I don't know. You know, we could name them. Are there any game shows out there that maybe you wish that you had been the host of instead of...
No doubt about it. Jeopardy. I think it's the best format ever. Merv Griffin came up with that thanks to his wife. They were laying in bed one night talking about games, and she said, "What if you gave the answer?" And he said, "What?" Yeah, you give the answer and let the person come up with the question. He's the one who came up with the idea for Jeopardy. And I can't think of a better format. I'll give you the answer, you give me the question. How do you beat that? Of course, it's difficult. We went to see. I never go to tapings of game shows, but just this past month, several of us went to see tapings of both Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune at Sony over in Culver City here in California. It was really interesting. In fact, every time Alex would come out during commercial breaks, we almost had a regular dialogue going between us and the audience, you know, talking about game shows and my career and his career. So, yeah, Jeopardy would be my favorite. Of course, he's been doing it for 35 years. What a gig that turned out to be. And Pat Sajak on Wheel of Fortune and Vanna White, same thing.
Yes, absolutely amazing. You would not expect that type of longevity with something like
this. But Jeopardy is the one that I would love to have hosted. There are a couple of others. I love Hollywood Squares. I thought Peter Marshall did a terrific job on that. A lot of fun, you know, funny lines, just a fun show to do. So that would have been fun to do, too.
I would say. Well, I want to wrap it up with something so incidental, but something that I think is so cool. We mentioned winkmartindale.org, and there you can find so many wonderful things. Here's your bio, photos. There's a lot of cool creations by Sandy, sunglasses and whatnot, things like that, and purses and creations by Sandy. People just should just go to winkmartindale.org to see these. But the thing that really called out to me is Wink Martindale's Rocket Fizz Soda.
Yeah, a friend of ours who owns that company came to me, and they put different celebrities on labels and put out a drink with their name on it. And he came to me, and we love Hawaii so much, so we wanted a Hawaiian-type drink, so that's what it is. And this was about 5 or 6 years ago, and they sell pretty well. It's a drink that's a little too sweet for me, but I get my little royalty checks. I couldn't pay my mortgage with it, but I get my little royalty checks. And again, it's fun to have your picture on a soft drink. I mean, how many people can say that? And by the way, Sandy is my entrepreneurial wife. She dated Elvis, or she likes to say he dated her, for 6 years, long before we ever met, back in the 1960s. But that's another story for another time. But she produces all of these products, and they're on sale at Graceland. So if anybody wants to go to winkmartindale.org and see these various items, sunglasses, etc., with Elvis's name on them, they'll find them there, and they're very reasonably priced. But if they go to Graceland, they'll also see all of these products in a very nice case there as well.
Beautiful. Let's see, we, I guess, started off talking about your singing career and ended up talking about your soda pop. So. Thank you, though, for everything in between. You've got to hear this all the time, but I'm just going to say that this was a treat for me. I mentioned that you were part of me growing up in the early 70s and even into the later 70s and 80s. You were a part of my childhood. I love the game shows. And you mentioned what makes a game show successful, and that is the KISS formula, the keep it simple, stupid formula. But why do you think that game shows have had such a resonance with the public? I almost said the American public. public, but of course it goes beyond that. And again, this goes beyond television itself. At one point, we gathered around the radio for these game shows. It's not just enjoyment and entertainment. There's something that really connects us. Is it that hope that we can win a $3,600 car?
I think that people at home love to watch other people win. People at home sitting in their den watching Hangman, which is Wheel of Fortune, or Tic-Tac-Toe, three X's or O's, vertically, diagonally, horizontally, so simple. I'll give you the answer, you give me the question, as on Jeopardy. People sit at home and they place themselves on that set and on that game, and they like to think about, how would I do if I were there? Of course, as you know, David, it always is much easier when you're at home in your den watching on television than it would be when you're actually on the show. But people love games. They've been here since the early days of radio. They'll always be around because, what is the song title? Games people play. People love to play games, and the simpler the better. And they just like to see other people win. I think that's the answer. People like to see other people happy and win, and they like the challenge of seeing how well they would do were they up there on that stage.
It's sort of a fantasy that we can all play along with.
Correct. Exactly.
Nice. Nice. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past KVCR's programs can be found via podcast through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. It's been Conversation with Wink Martindale for the majority of tonight's program. More at winkmartindale.com. Now to close out the show and to close out this holiday season, Songbird, a duo comprised of McCall Potter and KVCR's Benjamin Perper.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
Till the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, the rod of Jesse free, thine own from Satan's tyranny. From depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Thy tribes on Sinai's height, in ancient time didst give the law, in cloud and majesty and awe. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Emmanuel. You.
A couple of seasonal tunes from Songbird to wrap up the season and to wrap up this edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Songbird, that is McCall Potter, and KVCR's Benjamin Perper. Thanks as well to Wink Martindale and to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions for getting me in touch with Martindale. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.